This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can now download as a podcast off our website at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to be able to speak with Felice Yeskel, co-author of Economic Apartheid in America, a newly updated primer on economic inequality and insecurity here. Felice Yeskel, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt.
Now, you're a co-founder of United for a Fair Economy. How did you get involved in this subject matter of class and economic inequality?
I guess that's a threefold answer, really. There's the personal level, and personally, class was the first inequality that affected me. I grew up in New York City on the Lower East Side. My father was an immigrant to this country from Poland, and at the age of five, I was sent uptown to 68th Street and Park Avenue to Hunter College Elementary School. I took two buses every day to go to school, and not only did I cross the miles, but I crossed the cultures. So here was this working-class kid going to an elite, although public, very elite school. Neither of my parents had been to college, and I didn't have a name for what made me feel so different. But the difference was class. I never once invited a single child home from elementary school the whole time I was in elementary school.
And why was that?
Because I felt so ashamed of where I came from, really. And I was clear that my family was nothing like the families of my friends at school, nothing like Dick and Jane, nothing like what was presented as the American way to be. And it wasn't until I was in my mid-20s, really, that I discovered the name for what had made me feel so alienated and so different was a class thing.
So that was the personal dimension. What were the other couple?
Well, the other couple were more professional and political. I'd been doing a lot of education and training work around the range of isms. I was a diversity trainer for a lot of years and, you know, taught classes at the university and in the social change movement about racism, about sexism, heterosexism, even anti-Semitism at the university.
So these are some of the other inequalities that you encountered.
Somewhere along the line, yes. But surprisingly, I didn't really meet anybody in the whole sort of diversity training movement that talks about sort of structural inequality more as it affects people on an interpersonal and organizational level, who is naming class as anything that impacted our lives, anything that was a part of our identity or affected our realities. And it's sure it affected mine. So I started talking about classism, started developing curricula and teaching about issues of classism. And the resistance that I was met with was just shocking to me.
What was that like?
I remember some students at UMass, where I was teaching in a program called the Social Justice Education Program, went to the dean to complain because I taught about all these isms, and, you know, there's always resistance. You know, people don't want to think of themselves as bad in any way. So to get people to own their racism or their sexism or their anything is a bit of a struggle. But when it came to classism, it was sort of like people were acting like, well, don't you believe in America? And I remember once I gave an assignment to small groups and I said, please, you know, in your small group, talk about your visions of what a society without classism would look like. That was it. A society without classism. So one group was just sort of sitting there, not engaging. So I walked over and I said, did you not understand the instructions? Can I help? And they're like, we believe in democracy. And I'm like, yeah, so do I. Well, what's the problem? And we can't design a, you know, a classless society. That's anti-democratic. And I'm like, oh. So the conflation of capitalism with democracy and inequality is an essential facet of democracy. And the confusion about all of those, I think, makes talking and teaching about classism a whole different thing.
And boy, that's something that the Bush administration loves, and the people who run this country love, just to conflate those two things. We're for democracy, we're for freedom, we're for capitalism, and inequality is just a natural part of that.
In fact, it's an essential part of that, because you need that incentive system built right in. You know, it's interesting, because when you talk about, you know, ending racism, it doesn't mean the elimination of people of European descent. When you talk about ending sexism, you're not going to end the existence of males. But when you talk about ending classism, it's kind of hard to have an owning class and to end classism.
And was the resistance in the classroom mostly from people who were of privilege?
You know, that's the other sad thing about this issue. No, because it's a state university. And, you know, I'd say they were middle class. But we weren't talking about the elite. Now, I've also had these conversations at Amherst College and Smith and other elite universities in this country. And there we are talking to some of the children of privilege. I mean, extreme privilege. But I've found that in doing this work and talking about economic justice and fairness, we, as a society, are conditioned to identify upward and to identify with the interests of those on top. One time I was going somewhere, I was living in Boston at the time, and I was going out to do a talk on economic inequality and insecurity, and I was taking a cab to Logan because it was so early in the morning, and I was talking to the cab driver about what I was doing, and he said, well, you know, I'm not rich. Lord knows I wouldn't be driving this cab if I was rich, but if I made a lot of money, I wouldn't want anybody taxing it. And that, in that one sentence, is like, if I someday get to be, you know, Bill Gates, I want to be able to keep my money. Why are you thinking that you are ever going to get a shot at Bill Gates' life?
And isn't that incredible, Feliciesco, because that is a very common reaction when you get down to the estate tax question. Because I see polls that say more than 50% of Americans want to get rid of the estate tax, even though it helps only the top 0.5%.
Want to get rid of it or want to keep it?
I want to, yeah, only everyone, more than 50% want to get rid of it. Want to get rid of the estate tax, abolish the estate tax.
Okay, so 50 want to keep it, 50 want to get rid of it, and really it only benefits a fraction of the wealthiest. Exactly, because there is some sense that we have a lot of mythology about wealth creation and where it came from. A lot of mythology that doesn't allow for understanding the role of society or our sort of social support in wealth creation. So the whole self-made, quote-unquote, man theory and the idea of a meritocracy and people work hard and by their own efforts and the sweat of their brow, they, you know, develop a bigger mousetrap or a better mousetrap. And
I mean, some do, but your book says that 50% of the people in the Fortune 400 inherited their money.
Right. Well, you know, I think it's interesting. If you think about capitalism and you think about the idea that inequality, people argue you need a certain amount of inequality because otherwise, why would someone get up earlier and work harder? So you want to reward that kind of industriousness. Well, if you think about inheritance, I think about inheritance as the biggest anti-incentive program going. If someone's just going to hand you a big wad of money, you never have to do anything. So why not, if you're really serious about making capitalism work, why not abolish inheritance? But, you know, the same people who will vociferously want to get rid of the estate tax and enshrine an aristocracy in our country are the same people that say you need an incentive to get people to work.
Also, I mean, if you really believed in equality of opportunity, you'd get rid of it. I mean, I remember reading a column by George Will about 5 years ago. When push comes to shove, we said equality of opportunity is not what we're interested in. We want to be able to protect the ability of families to pass on things to their kids. So, I mean, at least he addressed,
he was honest.
He addressed the conflict. But it is kind of stunning to me. Now, tell me a little bit about the book Economic Apartheid in America. This is the revised edition. Is the word apartheid too strong? Because it refers, of course, to the system of racial segregation and racial oppression in South Africa.
Well, you know, I wasn't totally comfortable with that name at the get-go, partially because I think it's hard to take one experience and apply it to a totally different context. So whether it's too strong or not isn't the issue for me. It's whether it's appropriate or not. But I think that we wrote the book as a way to say we are becoming two countries, one for the haves and one for the rest of us. We are pulling apart as a society, and we are becoming like many of the developing nations where if you're lucky enough to own your own home, you better have barbed wire and razor wire on top because there are hungry people all around. And I think that is the kind of society we are now becoming.
You're echoing John Edwards' speech a little bit. What did you make of that speech, and what did you make of his efforts on this issue?
Well, I think he was right on. I think the idea of two Americas is true. Maybe there are 22 Americas rather than two. It was a little simplistic, but that vivid image of how can we be one society when income and wealth and benefits and opportunities are becoming so spread apart, so unfair, so inequitable. I think that was right.
One of the goals of the book and of your group, United for a Fair Economy, and also your new group, Class Action, seems to be to demystify economics. There's been a big effort among liberal, radical, progressive economists over the last 30 years. I'm thinking about the group Dollars and Cents and the
Center for Popular Economics.
Right, all of that going on. And this book is really ideal for that because you really make it simple. I mean, you don't need to be an economics graduate student to understand it. But I think the shrouding of economics in mystery and profundity is itself a way to shield the people who are making the decisions from accountability.
Absolutely. I think one of the things about this book and one of the reasons that we wrote it, I personally have never taken an economics course in my life. I'm not an economist. And I think that one of the things that we need more than ever is for everyone to step up to the plate and feel like they have a right to talk about the economy. That when you get down to it, economics is not a science. Economics is about values. And that each of us has a right to speak up about the kind of society we want to live in, what we think is valuable, what we think is not. So I've led workshops for hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people across the country from all walks of life, all ages, from junior high school or middle school kids on up. And some of the kinds of participatory demonstrations we do are very powerful and communicate economic concepts in clear language. Economic Apartheid as a book is full of cartoons, easily understandable graphs. Basically, we talk in real language. And real people get it. You ask people, what's going on for you really, your family, your life, and your community? How is it working? What's good about the economy? What's hard? People can give you a fairly right-on analysis based on their own personal experiences. If you give them a little bit of a framework to put that in, it's there. And I think it is important for all of us to feel like we can talk about it and not be mystified by the lingo and rhetoric of people who'd rather keep us in the dark.
Yeah, people like Alan Greenspan, for one, who always tries to be inscrutable. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today is Felice Yeskel, co-author of Economic Apartheid in America. One thing about the economy that we hear and we read about, it's going well. It's doing fine. We're still into, you know, month 30 whatever of a recovery. Doesn't seem like a recovery to a lot of Americans. Why is that?
Why is that? Because it's not really a recovery. essentially, the economy is working well for stockholders. If you're someone who depends on wages for your living, you're having a hard time. If you happen to own property, especially real estate nowadays, it used to be more stocks and bonds, then you were doing well. But it used to be one job could provide an income for a family. Now, sometimes two incomes don't do it. One job used to be able to do it. Now, two jobs don't do it. People are working more hours. People are going deeper in debt in order to basically meet their basic needs. When you account for inflation, average wages have not increased since 1973.
See, that is such a startling statistic for me. And I see it, I read about it, that that's what's happening. People are just either stagnating or they're losing their real incomes. Why aren't people just up in arms over that?
Well, I think that part of the reason that a lot of people haven't felt the pinch is that people have gone deeply in debt. As long as we've democratized credit, so all of us have access to credit cards, so we can get the latest technological gadget.
At a price.
At a price. And, you know, a lot of times people say, well, you know, it's hard to believe what you're saying, Felice, because, you know, I walk down the street and every other kid has a cell phone or, you know, a Walkman or, no, it's not a Walkman now, iPod.
iPod.
Yeah, that's what it is, an iPod. So how could it be that, you know, the economy is, you know, as bad as you say or things are as unequal when so many people have these toys? And, you know, when you think about it, technological toys have gotten cheaper and cheaper. What's gotten more expensive? Housing, healthcare, education, childcare, the things that people really need. So people are paying more and more of their wages for rent or a place to live. College education is getting out of reach of ordinary people. Healthcare, so many people without healthcare are paying such a huge amount. I mean, healthcare costs are the major reason people go into bankruptcy in this country. It's not because they're, you know, buying, you know, unnecessary items. But I think that because certain people feel like their standard of living is raised because, you know, now people have not one TV, but two or three. Those things have gotten cheaper. That's part of the reason why we don't notice the pinch. But I think debt and working more hours is another big part of it.
We have this two Americas that you were talking about, John Edwards talks about. Mm-hmm. We also have this two-tiered economy that businesses are gearing their markets to that top 1%, 5%. There's a statistic in this book, Felice Yeskel, the book Economic Apartheid in America, that was so striking to me. It's a prediction by an economist that within the next 10 years, top 1% or 5% will account for 60% of the purchasing power in this country. Seems to me it's possible that those who are in a position of power and wealth in this society can so jimmy the economy that they don't really care whether the bottom half of this country is doing well or not, because the economy doesn't depend on that purchasing power.
Well, you know, the economy may not depend. I find that a little hard to believe, but even if the economy didn't depend on that purchasing power, our society depends on us sharing a common fate. There has been so much disinvestment in the common good, whether that's public education or public transportation or public parks or public libraries, or because people with a lot of wealth are able to privatize their needs. That is just disinvested from our sense of community. It's almost like when the social fabric starts to pull apart, it can only stretch but so far before it starts to rip. I think what we're seeing now is a two-tiered economy. We see gated communities on both ends. We see gated communities with private security forces for the wealthy, and we see prisons for the people on the other end of the extreme, with more and more people falling into the chasm between. I think whether the economy can make it on the purchasing power of the top 5% is one thing. Whether we as a society can make it is an entirely different thing.
You know, Felice Yeskel, I would have thought the garment would have started to rip a while ago, but we did see it start to rip at Katrina. We did see what it looked like when people who were poor and people who were black were just being totally neglected, left out to die is what it looked like. And in some cases, what
literally,
it actually was,
yes,
left out to drown. What has the impact of Katrina been on this issue?
Well, interestingly enough, one of the talks I've been giving, I've been doing some touring, I've been on college campuses and in communities, and I give a talk called What Katrina Revealed, Economic Apartheid in America. And, you know, if I were ever a little bit concerned about the title of that book, it felt like Katrina was a perfect, you know, image that made that title seem okay. Because I think race and class are so incredibly intertwined in this country, and people of color are so overrepresented among folks who are suffering and on the bottom rungs of society, and clearly people of European descent are clearly way overrepresented in the top tiers.
And sometimes race is shorthand for class.
Right. And I think that part of the reason we haven't had a deeper conversation in our country about class is because a lot of what is class gets named race. And it's, you know, race has also been something that has stopped people from uniting with common class interests because of the racial divide. So it is all very complex, but there Katrina was. Any illusion was, you know, wiped away. The veil was lifted, and we could see what miserable poverty looked like. Of course, our response as a nation, or our lack of response as a nation, now we have, okay, we have to help rebuild the Gulf Coast. How are we rebuilding the Gulf Coast? We're rebuilding the Gulf Coast by giving yet still more tax breaks to the wealthiest and cutting social spending for programs that benefit poor people all over the country to help a few poor people who happen to live on the Gulf Coast. It makes absolutely no sense. So we are not really addressing poverty in this country. You know, I don't think we're even addressing poverty on the Gulf Coast. If we look at who's benefiting by the huge amount of federal dollars that are going down there, it's large corporations. It's Halliburton. It isn't small businesses. So I think class can be revealed by Katrina at every step of the way. Why weren't the levies fixed in advance? Well, that wasn't the nation's priority. The nation's priority was cutting the estate tax and cutting tax breaks for the wealthiest. Why in the rebuilding aren't the people who are most affected being able to get make money in the rebuilding effort? Why? Because cronyism has trumped, you know, what's right. But I think that poverty itself has been revealed a bit by Katrina. But one of the points we make in economic apartheid in America is that while I think we could build a fair consensus that poverty is problematic and we wish we could do something about poverty, we want to maintain that poverty is problematic, but economic inequality is problematic. Even if people who were poor, standard of living went up, if the gap were to remain as big, it would be problematic.
Why?
Three reasons. Inequality totally impacts our democracy. You can't have a democracy when we have so much of a gap economically.
And this is a chicken and egg thing, too.
Exactly, because people use their money to invest in politicians, to change the rules, to benefit them. Yes, there it goes, the chicken and the egg and the chicken and the egg. I think it's really bad for our economy, although what you were saying before might mitigate against that. But it does seem kind of obvious to me that there are only so many McMansions and so many pieces of artwork or jewelry than any one consumer could buy. But if more people had access to more money, they would, renovate their house or buy a new car or get a new fridge or whatever. So it seems to me more money spread around would actually fuel the economy and help it grow at a faster rate than it's growing now. And finally, the thing I've mentioned a lot is our social fabric. I think that a society can only tolerate so much inequality when there are hungry people in the shadow of opulence. Then it takes a tremendous amount of repression to keep those people down.
I'm speaking with Felice Yesko, the co-author of Economic Apartheid in America. In the book, you explain that the problem of inequality in America is the problem of failures of our democracy. And you touched on that a little bit right there. I wanted you to elaborate on that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. If you were somebody in the top 1% of wealth holders in this country and you had excess money in your pocket, due to some tax breaks that you had gotten, you were trying to figure out what was the best investment you could possibly make with your money, the greatest return. Where were you going to get it? Well, you would get it if you invested in the political process. You would get it if you bought politicians. You would get it if you bought political access. Because what's happened is it's almost like a game of Monopoly. I think we use this analogy as well. It's like the first people who happened to pass go not only got their $200, but they got the ability to write the rules for the rest of the game. And we've become on a cycle of misfortune where power has shifted to wealthy corporations and individuals who use their accumulated wealth to influence the political process, which changes the rules of the economy to benefit them at the expense of everyone else. Ordinary people are having to work longer hours to just make ends meet, have less time, and because both political parties basically serve the interests of the wealthy, are less inclined to be involved politically, which further tips the balance of power.
So how do we reverse this cycle of misfortune?
Well, I think there are probably lots of places in a cycle that you can intervene, but clearly eliminating the influence of money from politics is an important piece. And campaign finance reform in any way that we can get it is really an essential key ingredient, because I think unless we are able to mitigate against the impact of money, it's going to be hard. We theoretically are still one person, one vote, but in practice, that's not in fact the case. I think alternative media, I think alternative politics, and I think building a mass movement for economic justice. There's so many pieces of the puzzle that people are organizing around, whether it's housing issues or healthcare issues or education issues. And I think if, as we did our organizing, we all were to hold out a vision of a more equitable system and made the same point over and over again in each of our single issues, that what we're looking at is unfair rules of the game that were tilted toward the wealthy at the expense of everyone else. I think people are disenfranchised with government, but they're even more disenfranchised with corporations. I think we need to help people understand that government is us more than we have in the past.
You say in the book that there are seeds of this movement across this country. Do you see those seeds taking root? Do you see that plant beginning to flower?
I do. You know, not as heartily as I would like, but certainly sprouting. You know, I think we see it in the living wage movement. I think we see it in some of the more radical elements of the union movement, where we're starting to organize among service workers, among new immigrants. I think we see it in the free higher education movement that's sort of taking place on many campuses. I think when we start to say, we're not going to put up with it anymore in our various ways, we start to see it. I think we say it in our individual lives when we realize, why am I working so hard? Do I really need all this stuff? I think, you know, some of it is, you know, getting off the rat race that each of us is individually on. And Class Action, the organization that we've started in the last year or so, really looks at some of the, not so much the structural things, but some of the mythology that supports the structure, some of our personal attitudes, how class affects our organizations and our organizing, so that we can build cross-class alliances to try to change the rules of the game.
Felice Yesko, I'd like you to give the website for Class Action and for United for a Fair Economy, and how can people get hold of economic apartheid in America?
Well, I'd love to, Matt. So Class Action is www.classism.org, United for a Fair Economy, faireconomy.org, and economic apartheid is accessible on either of those websites. If you go to www.classism.org or faireconomy.org, you can just click right through and get economic apartheid in America.
Felice Yesko, we only have about 30 seconds left. You emphasized how important is that vision of a more equal, more democratic society. Can you just paint it real quick for me?
Wow. I thought you were going to say what's really important is that people get active and do something. And I think that's what I'd like to leave the listeners with, that each and every one of us can do something, whether it's a small thing or a large thing, to help build toward a fairer economy for all. So I think that's what I'd like to encourage us all to do.
Well, I'm for that, too. Felice Yesko, thanks so much for being my guest today.
My pleasure, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.